Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. And we're back.
We're back
after a summer holiday.
Does it feel like a holiday?
No, it's gone by very quickly and it wasn't planned, was it? And now we're doing this. I felt like a natural barrier at the end of the first season, at the end of the second season. We'll call them seasons. What used to break over the summer holidays, Nathaniel?
What used to break? School.
Yeah. Yeah, but like, there used to be TV shows that would break over the summer holidays and then they'd
oh, yeah.
Come back
what did
again.
We have? I think you probably things like Tomorrow's World and things like that, I think probably took a series. When it was like sport, wasn't it? You'd have sport all summer and they didn't bother putting. So Going Live used to take a break over the summer.
Yes, that's right. So this is a little bit like. I'm Andy Peters, you're Emma Forbes. We've taken a little break over the summer, and now we're back. We're back, right in time for summer.
And we're about to be replaced by the stars of the ozone, who are going to come in and sweep and take our jobs.
Who was in the ozone?
It was, wasn't it, Zoe Ball and Jamie Thigston ended up taking over, didn't they?
Oh, wow, I can't remember the... I can remember the ozone now you say it. But I couldn't. And what were their sort of like comedy interlude characters on the ozone?
Oh, on oh god, so yeah, Trevor and Simon on Going Live and Live and Kicking. And I think for a while I can't think what they were called. They did. I think they replaced them for a bit, didn't they? They had some new ones.
Yeah, I remember Mark Heap and Steve Frost were on What's Up Doc on ITV.
Yes, they were.
And What's Up Doc really was all about the content, wasn't it?
For sure.
It had Animaniacs, Tiny Toons, and Batman the Animated Series.
Incredible lineup.
Just absolutely, there was no such thing as BBC One after What's Up Doc started.
No.
It was just blew it out of the water. But it's all about the content. Well, I'd say that the presenters on BBC were more memorable. But I don't remember what shows that they showed. But I remember that ITV always had the best, because they were adverts for toys, weren't they?
So, yes, they had the best ones.
You had your Earthworm Jims, your Samurai Pizza Cats, your Rude Dog and the Dweebs. They were all ITV. I'm sure Rude Dog and the Dweebs was ITV, right?
I think Rude Dog and the Dweebs might have been BBC. In my mind, that's a BBC.
That wasn't a toy line, was it?
No.
And then
that was
what
just
else
a cool...
was there?
I guess you would have had all the toy line ones, your He-Man, your Transformers. Although I think BBC had Thundercats, didn't they? Controversially.
And Turtles. BBC had Turtles.
They did too. Oof, the Turn Traitor.
BBC had Turtles, but I remember there being sort of like lots of stuff at the time. The head of BBC was, I can't remember what her name was. Or maybe it was the head of children's programme, but the head of BBC, and basically she was saying that she got duped into purchasing the Turtles, because she only realised afterwards that it was basically it's a half-hour toy commercial.
I bet that worked out all right for it, though.
If you're working in the kids in kids TV, you must be aware of that, surely.
Mm.
Real Ghostbusters, that was ITV, but that was weekdays. Garfield and Friends, weekdays. That wasn't your Saturday morning stuff. The Toxic Avenger. No, what's he called? The Toxic Crusader. That was
Toxic
the
Crusaders. Game. Yeah.
That was Troma. That is basically
a kids' TV show based on a sort of foul, violent,
a violent series of films that centre around rape and AIDS jokes. They decided to turn into a kids' TV series.
Perfect.
For Saturday mornings. You get absolutely perfect. So there you go. That is... Sorry, anyway, we're back. You look incredible, Nathaniel. Have you lost loads of weight?
No, do you know what it is? I do this on my brother's desktop computer, and he's got a better screen, and it just makes me look better. It holds the light better. So I look all right, but I'm the same inside. You know, I'm still exactly the same. but the light holds better, so it looks more professional setup. It's got a better camera on it, I think. Better lenses. Yeah,
I think you're slightly out of focus, if anything, but you look absolutely incredible. Your hair is great. Your skin is great.
Thank you.
Your shirt seems to be clean.
It is clean.
You look well rested and at peace with yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. I feel quite tired. I've since gone back to work, so I've been very busy for two weeks.
Take a fucking compliment, all right?
Oh, well, yeah. I was about to return the compliment. But never mind.
You don't look tired at all. How is work?
It's busy. Well, I feel busy. I mean, like, I feel like I've been in a lot, and it's all right. You know, I've seen a film. I saw, well, barely a film, really. I saw a film called The Human Voice, which is a new Pedro Almodovar film, but it's only half an hour long. So you go to the cinema.
Yeah.
It's Tilda Swinton. So it's just her on her own.
What's it called? The Human Voice?
Yeah. And it's he's made it.
It's not the Paddy McGuinness thing that's on Saturday night.
No, it's not that, no. They haven't put that on. That would be quite desperate for content if they're putting on the Paddy McGuinness show. This is like... it's just... His new film just happens to be 30 minutes long. And so to pad it out, you have the film and then an interview with Pedro Almodovar and Tilda Swinton with Mark Kermode. But what's great about it is you go to the cinema, see a film for half an hour, see a little Q&A after, and it's an hour and a quarter. Done. Back in the world.
What? So it's half hour. Isn't it good?
Yeah, it's good. You know, it's not mind-blowing, but it's nice to see someone in the cinema again. It's like a one-woman monologue, essentially, with Tilda Swinton walking around her house on the phone.
What's it called? The Sound of My Voice?
It's called The Human Voice.
Right, okay.
And I think it's like a Bunuel film or something. It's based on like an old... I think it's a play that Bunuel wrote.
Bunuel?
I have Bunuel, thank you. Thanks for asking. How have you, Boone?
No, come on, let's not talk about that. Let's keep avoiding, keep deflecting.
Keep it light.
Let's keep deflecting how I've been. How have you been?
I've been busy.
I went for a drink with our mutual friend Jason Dawson on Sunday. And I had a couple of Cokes, Diet Cokes, and he had, I can't remember what he had. And we had a little nice little catch up, and at the end of it, the waiter came over and he said, this sounds like a humble brag. I suppose it is a humble brag, but most people that know me know that I don't have that in me. The waiter came over and said, oh, I'm a massive fan of... Because Jason is a producer, he's a TV producer, and he produces Russell... He used to produce Russell Howard's Good News, 5 years younger than me, but he's done very well for himself. And the waiter came over and he said, oh, I'm such a massive fan of Uncle. And I just said, thank you. And this is Jason. He put me on TV for the first time 11 years ago. and then I stepped away from it and I let them chat. And Jason just said, that was absolutely stunning deflection. and I genuinely just didn't know what to do with it. So I went past the cinema, right? So you work at a cinema. You don't really like talking about it, but you work at a cinema. But we both love the cinema more than anything in the world, I think.
Yeah.
And if not the cinema, films. And cinema, a close second. But I went past the cinema yesterday. No, maybe Monday. And two posters were in the cinema, which I just found really interesting. One of them was for Tom Cruise, Top Gun Maverick.
Sure.
And it says, in cinemas and IMAX, summer 2020.
Yeah? Yeah.
I imagine it's coming out soon.
I'm trying to keep up with release dates. They keep moving. I thought it was like July.
It didn't come out in summer 2020, right?
No, I certainly didn't do that.
And the Odeon Lux have had like this big sort of like reopening thing. It feels like it's been shut. Hey, we're open. And to celebrate, they've put a poster for Top Gun Maverick saying it's coming summer 2020. Then the other end of the scale is James Bond, No Time to Die. And that just says, in cinemas, 2021, hopefully, in cinemas at some point, 2021. And then they'll be giving the posters out to the cinema and say, see this poster? That's good all year, that is. and we'll be giving out new posters for next No Time year. To Die next year. It's like your calendar. It's like your 2021 calendar is a No Time to Die poster. You go, very similar to my 2020 calendar. When was No Time to Die meant to come out? 2019?
Yeah, no. I could have. Will it be? No, it was meant to come out, I think, 2020, like April, I think. April 2020. A Quiet Place. Part 2.
Yeah.
That's out this week. And that was the film that was going to open the week before the pandemic started.
See, now, A Quiet Place 2, if you'd have told me that was out on Netflix and it had already been at the cinema, I'd have gone like, yeah, sure. I mean, like, absolutely, absolutely fucking, I've got no idea. But No Time to Die, it was meant to come out, what, April 2020, and then delayed it to September, and then they went, nah, November, Christmas. And then we went, nah, it'll be definitely the new year. No, fuck it, at some point in 2021. It's definitely had, like, five delays.
Yeah.
And some of them might have been secret reshoots. I don't give a fuck about James Bond. I just think it's really interesting that they've totally given up.
Well, I think it's gone, like they haven't issued new posters for anything. So everyone's got these old dated posters that have the completely wrong date on it. Hopefully some of them I think just say things like coming in August and you go, well, maybe. But it was going to be August 2020, and you kind of hope it sort of lines up again, that you can go, that's still valid, still makes sense.
Absolutely, still valid. Or they'll just be, like, sending out Sharpies to cinemas everywhere. Just you do it yourself. Like, posters are just coming out with months and dates on them, and then you're meant to just scribble out the ones that aren't applicable. It's so interesting. It is, because that is, you know, like when you in I Am Legend, the Will Smith movie, and New York is deserted, and there's a poster for Batman versus Superman that's in Times Square for this film that they'll never make that, will they? That'll never come out. And Will Smith is like walking around this deserted New York and there's posters for films that never come out. And it's sort of like that, going past. I mean, to make it really, it's like, it's a nerd within a nerd. It's like, oh, I was looking at the posters for the cinema, and I saw that the sequel to Top Gun, called Top Gun Maverick, the poster, which was rather amusing to me, said that it was coming out in summer 2020, which reminds me, of course, of the the third adaptation of the novel I Am Legend, following on, obviously, from The Last Man on Earth and Omega Man, starring Charlton Heston. And it reminds me of the rather amusing scene in Times Square. It's completely deserted, and there's a poster for the, as of the time, fictional movie, Batman vs. Superman. That's what sprung to mind as I was walking through Holloway Road on a beautiful roasting bank holiday Monday. Anyway, Nathaniel, how have you been?
If you had a blog, that's what it would be. It's like one. It's like a scene from Alan Bennett's diaries. What a beautiful little small tale.
If I had a blog, it would be one entry directly preceding my suicide. I think I did have a blog. We've talked about this, surely. I had a blog years ago where it was me getting ready for Edinburgh, and I was just like, I'm going to let you in behind the scenes, take you step by step through the process of writing an Edinburgh show. And then that was like, you know, March 2009. and then in August, no, it wouldn't have been August, but in like November 2010, it was like, I've done it. It was like two entries, and it was like, yeah, fuck it. I'm not one for, I've stopped making a record of all the films that I've seen on Twitter because I felt too sad about it. It was the numbers were so high.
Yeah, so when I they start just, stacking up.
I just save the poster on my phone on Photos, and then I scroll through it and remember all of the films that I've seen. But I've stopped telling people. So how's Letterboxd working out for you?
Yeah, it's good because it's kind of easier. I don't have to. It's just like a nice little, you put it in there and you can kind of forget about it. Whereas before it felt like there was a pressure to do. One thing I don't really like about it, I don't like having to put it encourages it to put like a star rating in. And it makes, when doing it, just makes me think what a worthless idea all star ratings are on films. It's like, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, it doesn't mean anything. I was having a conversation last night, in fact, about Adam Sandler films. And I was like saying, all Adam Sandler films that are an Adam Sandler film, not including Uncut Gems and Punch Drunk Love and stuff like that, that are films that he is in, but all Adam Sandler films are between 1 and 3 stars.
Mm.
And I would still pick a 1-star Adam Sandler film over a lot of films if I'm just sort of like, if I just want to put something. I don't know. I mean, as soon as you start saying it out loud, it sounds insane.
No, I think I've realised that almost the best films, when you've got a star rating, I'll go, oh, I love this. And I go to give it a star rating, and in your head you go, oh, I love this film. 3.5. But I love it. Watch it loads. 3.5. Brilliant.
But it's. I don't think that they're comparable to each other. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, you know, if you say 50 First Dates is a 3-star movie, and then you see Citizen Kane, and you go, yeah, I think that was good, but it's aged in places. I'd say it's like 3 stars, and Casablanca's 5 stars. You're not like saying that 50 First Dates is as good as, do you know what I mean? And you might not even be saying that Citizen Kane is as good as 50 First Dates, because when you want to sit down and watch something, it's not necessarily going to be up until 2008, or whenever it was, the greatest film of all time, Casablanca. It might just be, oh, that film with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. So they're not necessarily even like-for-like. It can just be like how you're feeling at that time. You can only really compare an Adam Sandler film to another Adam Sandler film, because exactly. it's the only sane barometer. Do you know what I mean? You can't be comparing it to actual things.
Well, aside from that, 51st date, not 51st dates. 51st
date. Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's 51st state with.
Oh yeah, with Adam Sandler and
Samuel L. Jackson one, the 51st date.
Yes, yes. I know all along.
I know, you know.
He plays a character called McElroy, right?
He does.
And I was always like, is that going to be like, because he's Scottish in it, hasn't he? He's got Scottish descendancy. So the 51st state is in is in relation to Britain being America's 51st state. Is that right?
Exactly. That's my understanding.
Great Britain. And Samuel Jackson, it was written by a cab driver. Yes. And he handed it to the right person, and then it got made into a film. And when did it come out? 2000, 2001, 98,
I bet. That's one for Natalie. I reckon later, I reckon about 2003.
I think 98. I think I went to see it with a girl, my girlfriend from sixth form. And it would have been before I went to university. It was
2001.
Fuck off. Oh. Well, what was I doing with her in 2001? Well, I was watching the 51st State. And Samuel Jackson has Scottish descendancy, so he wears a kilt for the film. Who's the guy in it? Is it Robert Carlyle?
Yes, Robert Carlyle.
And who's the bad guy in it?
Oh, I remember it's got Meatloaf in it, hasn't it?
Yes. It's like, it's sort of American, but it's 1,000,000% a British production.
Absolutely.
And they've got enough money for a kind of a genuine American star in Samuel L. Jackson, but he is also the kind of guy that would do absolutely anything.
Absolutely.
And then you've got...
Perfect.
Then you've got Meatloaf, who is... He was the bus driver on Spice World. So it's just kind of like... It's not like, oh, wow, we've got, guess who we've got? It's kind of like you've got a guy that's already proven that he is up for anything. So you've got Meatloaf. And it's trying to make it feel a little bit more international, but it's basically an American thing. So Sean Pertree, Rhys Ifans, and, of course, Cheggers. So they're all in it.
It's got Sinbad from Brookside in it as well. That's what I remembered.
That's and, right.
And it's lovely to see him on screen. Big fan of Sinbad. So it was a treat.
And Samuel L. Jackson is called McElroy. And
that's right.
I was just like, isn't that McElroy?
Yes.
Aren't they saying, aren't they? Because that's like, well, I don't know how else it is, but Elmer McElroy, but they call him McElroy. But it's like Tim McInerney. And I always thought it was Tim McInerney.
Yes. But yeah, I was about to say, but you've just disputed it. Perhaps one is like an American pronunciation, but I think you're... No, that doesn't make sense, does it? You're right.
Tim McInerney, I was just pronouncing it wrong my whole life. But McElroy, I just remember at the time, and this was back in 2001, I remember turning around to Emma at the time and said, why are they calling him McElroy? And Emma was gone. So that's the 51st. Have you seen it recently?
No, I haven't seen it recently. But when I saw it at the cinema, as I was leaving, this is just what I mean about star ratings and what they mean, is that there was a guy leaving in front of me, and he turned to his mate and said, that's the best film I've ever seen. And I quite liked it. Like, I thought it was a perfectly watchable film. Perfectly watchable, but I remember that really stuck with me. I think about it all the time. I go, the best film you've ever seen. I don't even believe it's the best Sinbad from Brookside film. it's certainly not Samuel L. Jackson's best film, because it made me think, how many films have you seen? That man has always fascinated me. fascinated me, that comment.
Because I went, you know, I had a bit of material about this, about Sliding Doors, and someone said Sliding Doors is their favourite film, and I was like, it's your favourite film? I was like, you better have only seen one film. Do you know what I mean? Like, as soon as you see another film, Sliding Doors is your second favourite film. Do you know what I mean? It came out at a time where it was basically, it was like this Quentin Tarantino / Guy Ritchie inspired gangster movie, which unbelievably they managed to get Samuel L. Jackson to actually be in.
Yeah.
And you kind of like go, wow, okay, we're off. I remember seeing it at the cinema, and I remember obviously all of the details that I've just said are the details I remember. I remember the poster, and I've never thought about it since, I don't think. It's like one of those films where it pops in your head like once every 8 years, maybe, and you're like, did that happen? And you're like, yeah, it did, yeah.
Samuel Jackson was a real gift at that time, because I think he almost continues to, right? Isn't one of his things that, unlike a lot of movie stars, he just loves to work, I believe. So he is just like, I think he still does about 5 movies a year. Like, he's like, yep, he just wants to keep working. And I think it's a real gift for a film like that. So he was probably number one choice for the 51st State, with an idea that we'll never get him. But of course, it just fits into his schedule, and he's there.
Yeah.
He will do anything. Like, as long as he's like, yeah, I'm happy to do that. If that, whatever the next film is in, just line them up with my agent and I'll keep doing them.
Well, I think, I imagine, as long as there are I don't think that Samuel L. Jackson being in a film can make or break a film. I don't think that putting Samuel L. Jackson in the film means that it's not going to be a blockbuster. But what it does is it gives it a certain level of credibility. So you put Samuel L. Jackson in the new Saw film, and it sort of makes me want to watch it out of curiosity, because Chris Rock came up with a story, and Chris Rock is, what's it called, Spiral?
Spiral, so the new,
the ninth, is it the ninth or the tenth Saw film in the series from the Book of Saw, a story from the Book of Saw, it's a movie called Spiral that's conceived and starring Chris Rock and stars Samuel Jackson as his dad. And maybe this is a bad example because I'm sort of intrigued to see it. But you put Samuel Jackson, I don't know, Samuel Jackson in Deep Blue Sea, and you kind of like go, it doesn't make me want to see the film more, but it's sort of like maybe a quality level. Whereas I think Bruce Willis likes working a lot, and so does Nicolas Cage, but they've done so much shit that it's kind of like you'll never trust a Nicolas Cage film again, really.
Yes,
you'll need like 8 other people's opinions before you take a punt on Willy's Wonderworld or Wonderland. Should be called Wonderworld. Whereas with Samuel L. Jackson, I don't think that his quality level has ever, dropped completely through. He's made good films and bad films, but he kind of like lends some sort of like gravitas to it. If
and he's
not
got
box office.
And again, he's like one of those actors, isn't he? Like De Niro or Nicholson, later Nicholson, where it's kind of, you know what he's going to do in a film. He's not someone who ever seems to challenge himself greatly. I don't mean that as a criticism, but he's got that sort of almost like, he's got like a sort of movie, he's like a movie star, but like a, but not a movie star. He's almost like second, he's like sort of sidekick, second person on the bill. But Samuel L. Jackson in a film is, you're paying for to have Samuel L. Jackson. He's like a character, isn't he? The Samuel L. Jackson character.
Do you know how many films Al Pacino made in the 80s?
No, I presume that's probably his peak period.
I think he made 4.
Really?
It was like 4 or 6. It's single figures. He hardly made any.
What is it, like Sea of Love, is it? Serpico?
I think Serpico was 70s.
Oh, maybe.
And then he sort of had like maybe a comeback with Dick Tracy, and then he did Carlito's Way, and then Scent of a Woman, and then it was like the opportunity show. He made a film called Author, Author. He did 6, yeah. Author, Author. He did one about the American Civil War. Scarface. That's 3, and then he did three others. I mean, we're kind of like waiting for Natalie to come up with a good thing. But yeah, it's crazy. But then when you look at someone like, so I would say if you look at Jack Nicholson, he started out in the 60s. He was a writer. He worked for Roger Corman. He was in loads of B movies, and then in the 70s, he sort of like started making a name for himself as an extraordinary actor. What a wonderful actor is Jack Nicholson. And then in 1980, of course, he makes The Shining, which is almost like a pastiche of a Jack Nicholson part. And then every part in the 80s is kind of like playing up to, not every part, that's not true. But then he's kind of like playing up to the fact that this is me. I think 80s was probably the time that he had like loads of fun, where he could jump between Witches of Eastwick and Jack Nicholson, and then he can Jack Nicholson, The Shining, Batman, and then he can sort of like jump back again and do stuff like When Was Man Trouble, 1990. But he's sort of like, and Reds, was he in Reds? And he kind of like is doing stuff with Warren Beatty and Danny DeVito. And then in the 90s, he's kind of, and when you have like Robert De Niro, it's kind of like he was this delicate, incredible actor in the 70s and the 80s. And then in the 90s, I think when he started making, yeah, Cruising, Author, Scarface, Revolution, Sea of Love, 5 films, and Into the Fire.
Okay.
Author is an absolutely, I like, it's a bonkers film. It's terrible. It's like a family sitcom starring Al Pacino as a playwright who looks after 12 kids. And they're all kind of like, he gets home after his play has opened, and there's 12 kids that have waited up for him, and they go, "How did the opening night go, Dad?" And he's like going, "Ah, oh, what can I say? Oh, and it's like Jack Nicholson hanging out with 12 kids writing plays. It's weird. It's just really weird. But with Robert De Niro, it's kind of like from about Casino onwards, it's kind of like, oh, we've seen this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Casino's like Goodfellas too. And then it's like, oh, well, if we put him in Analyze This, it's all of the baggage that comes with him. And then he's in a comedy. And then it becomes like a pastiche in itself. I've just watched, we've got to play a song. I've just watched the Meet the Parents trilogy in a 24-hour period. So,
And shall we find out about that after this?
No.
Well, okay, well, that's...
Just press play, mate.
Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back. What were we talking about? I'm just going to put them in an order. Parents, little fuckers, in that order. What have you been a fan of over the last?
Good question. What have I seen? I've seen a bunch of stuff. I tell you what, I saw a film I hadn't seen that was good. I saw the film Kong Skull Island, having seen the Godzilla film, and thought that was terrible. And Kong Skull Island.
The Godzilla film?
Yeah, I haven't seen Godzilla versus Kong.
You haven't seen Godzilla versus Kong? So there's three Godzilla, well, including, okay, right. So let's just do this in a systematic way, Nathaniel, instead of, you know, jumping in feet first like you always do. putting your jumper on sleeves first, and then the neck, and then the body. So let's just do this properly. So in what, 2013, 2014?
Something
there
like
was
that.
Godzilla came out.
Yeah.
The Godzilla remake. And then there was Kong Skull Island.
2017?
2017? I saw that at the cinema. And then there was Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And then there was Godzilla versus Kong that's just come out on... Well, just come out. It was meant to come out at the cinema. It's out at the cinema now.
Mm-hmm.
But I rented for $16.99 so that I could watch it amongst all of my recycling and rubbish in my living room. Gareth Edwards did Godzilla.
Yes, he did.
It seems like a good choice on paper because he did the low budget movie Monsters, which. I don't know how many people really saw Monsters, but I would recommend Monsters. I saw it within the last 2 years, and I think if you can get it on Blu-ray or DVD with all the extras, that is great, because I think the film is good. Monsters is a good film. 3 stars. But what actually knocks it out of the park is watching all of the extras and the DVDs that Gareth Edwards did, because he basically made this science fiction movie in his bedroom. He took two people. Is it Scoot McNairy?
Oh, I don't know.
It's the guy in Man of Steel who Bruce Wayne pulls out from underneath a girder at the beginning and is in a wheelchair, and Lex Luthor puts a bomb in his wheelchair and then they blow up Congress.
I know the bit. I don't know the actor.
It's not Congress, is it? But they blow up whatever it is. So it's that guy. He is in. I think it was his partner, and they went to South America and they improvised this film. And then when you watch the extras, basically, they just CGI'd every single signpost and all this stuff to make it look like it was all biohazard everywhere. They just filmed. Just daily life of these two people walking cross country, and then they just added all of this stuff in post-production, and it's almost like you can't really tell what they did. And there's a couple of shots of monsters, but you really see like these huge monsters from a human point of view. And you go, oh, we're going to reboot Godzilla. And you think, well, this guy's perfect because he's got this real vision of how to do it. And then and then Godzilla happened. So what do you think?
Well, I saw Godzilla off the back of King of Monsters coming out, and I go, oh, I quite fancy watching that, but I never saw that Godzilla film. So I watched it to try and catch up, and I watched it, and it put me off going to see any more Godzilla films. I just thought it was rubbish.
Yeah.
Total rubbish.
That's the one with Bryan Cranston, yeah?
Yeah, that's the one. And Aaron Taylor-Johnson?
Yeah, so Bryan Cranston's in it for 10 minutes. Then he gets killed, and then you're like, it's like Bruce Campbell in Congo, where you spend the whole film thinking he's going to come back, and he never does, and you're like, ah. And I would say I probably enjoy Congo more.
Mm. I definitely did, I think.
Right. So then what did you watch?
Then I didn't. But then I sort of thought, oh, I've done it again, where I've gone, I quite fancy watching Godzilla versus Kong. But then I was like, but I didn't like Godzilla. But I decided I probably would. Maybe I'll give Kong a go, because I've heard people say they like that. And I did. And I would say they were right. I'd say that's great.
Kong really Skull Island.
Yeah.
That's what it is, right? It's fun. I love it. I loved it at the cinema. I haven't really watched it back. I loved it so much that I bought a Richard Nixon bobblehead, because they have one in their helicopter. And it's like, I've got a Richard Nixon bobblehead, yeah. But it's a Kong Skull Island reference.
Yeah.
It's like, that's how nerdy, nerdy that's got. I just thought it was... And that's the thing where Samuel L. Jackson comes along. And you're not going to go and see Kong Skull Island because Samuel L. Jackson is in it. But he absolutely is the best thing in it, and he elevates it. And you're just like, well, he's the best thing in it next to Kong.
Yeah. So you've got in it, you've got Samuel L. Jackson and John Goodman. And you've just got this sort of the quite sort of really reliable people that as soon as they come on screen, you go, I like them. And you kind of need that in those movies. I think it's what it says, like you're saying about Bryan Cranston in Godzilla. It's like you kind of need to have a good cast of people that you're kind of enjoying the characters anyway. And the sort of monsters, like the bonus, you know.
Fun cast. You need to have a fun cast. And I don't necessarily mean Independence Day fun, but a cast of people that really you really trust to take you through having this good time. And Godzilla is not a fun film, but Kong Skull Island, which on paper you think is going to be shit. What I really like about it is they didn't just remake King Kong again.
Yeah.
They just were like, no, this is a new thing. And then I didn't see Godzilla King of the Monsters, but I did see Godzilla versus Kong within the last 2 weeks, I think.
And what did you make of it?
It's a combination of being one of the weirdest films I've ever seen and not being very good either. But it's sort of crazy, and it's kind of like, do you know what? I know that you've got the rights to King Kong and Godzilla, but they're different sizes. Godzilla is absolutely huge, and King Kong is like a giant ape. But like they've done them in the films, like God, you know, King Kong is like so much bigger than he needs to be, like in a ridiculous. Like you go, well, he must be what? It's like it breaks your brain. And then Godzilla is huge, and I appreciate what they're trying to do. It sort of like works in the old Toho studio days, where you've got two guys that are both 5'5" in giant rubber costumes and they're fighting each other. Yeah, that's fine. But actually, when you're watching a film like that and you're thinking about the logistics and you're thinking about like how the scale isn't quite right, and then it's kind of, yeah.
Well,
I wouldn't say it was disappointing. You can't even say that sort of thing is disappointing. It's maybe the sort of thing that you have to watch in the cinema and then never think about ever again.
I think part of the thing of Kong Skull Island did feel like a setup, because they seem to go to great lengths to point out how much bigger King Kong is than he has been in any other film. So you are going, all right, I get it. He's massive now.
Oh yeah. It's leading up to a team up, and the only reason why they've made him so big is because in the next film or in the film after that, they're going to team him up with Godzilla. But the fact of the matter, but what? So how many films are there now? There's four films in this franchise, and one of them is really fun. And then one of them is crazy, and then one of them is boring, and
neither of us have seen the other one.
And then neither of us have seen the other one, and it's kind of like, I'd watch another King Kong film.
Yeah. Well, that's it. They've created a thing where you're able to skip it. That's what I was like, actually, I don't want to see King of Monsters anymore. Forget it. But I will see Kong.
And it's obviously it's the Marvel route, but the thing is, Marvel have got access to hundreds of characters, and Godzilla and Kong, they've got two characters that neither of which are relatable. So you have to love the human cast. And I don't give a fuck about the human cast, and neither do they, really. They're all disposable. Even Samuel L. Jackson and John Goodman are kind of like, Brie Larson is in it, Tom Hiddleston is in it, and they're kind of like love them or hate them kind of performers. So it's kind of like, who's the guy that plays Kong? He's the guy
Terry Notary.
No. Terry Nutkins. Who?
In Kong Skull Island, isn't it? Isn't it the guy who's always doing the apes?
I thought it was...
Am I wrong? Maybe I'm wrong.
He's in it. He's the US trip that goes on his own on like a side adventure, and then they write out of the film. Toby Kebbell? What's his name?
Is that right? And they cast him as Kong? Doing somewhat like motion capture. I didn't realise this. Toby Kebbell.
He's in Dead Man's Shoes, and he plays like this character in the movie that kind of like fucks off at towards the end, and it is insignificant. But he's Kong, and he was in Planet of the Apes, wasn't he? He was the bad guy in Planet of the Apes.
Right.
So I guess he's sort of like, if Andy Serkis isn't free. And if Andy Serkis is a bit conged out because he did it in 2003, then you can bring him back. You can bring the other one back.
Yeah, just looking at it,
it's fine.
John C. Reilly, and you go, great. You've got all these sort of quite very likeable kind of character actor people in it, and Tom Hiddleston, who is sort of like.
Well, I just think that I don't remember Tom Hiddleston, so he couldn't have like spoiled the film, you know.
No, that's what I mean. He doesn't even spoil it. But when you watch it, you do go, you're miscast.
Well, yeah, he's sort of like Han Solo. He's meant to be at the beginning. They introduce him in kind of like an underground pool hall where he's hustling teenagers for racks of pool. And you kind of
beats
like,
up everyone in the bar.
Yeah, it's basically he's Indiana Jones or he's Han Solo, and it's kind of like, okay, who are you going to count? And okay, fine. But he doesn't sort of. I just think John C. Reilly is so broad and is having so much fun. It's kind of like he's in a different film from everyone else. But even that doesn't ruin the film. If anything, it goes, this is sort of like, you know, this tone that doesn't quite fit with everything else. That's sort of the tone that the whole film is.
Exactly. So I think it adds to the fun.
So that's all right.
Yeah, it's just the fun.
When you've got, like, what's his name, Taylor Johnson in the first film, in the Godzilla film, and he's so serious, and the film is so serious and dark, like visibly dark, it's difficult to see what's going on. So it's kind of like, it's difficult to... You're not having a fun time.
No. This has things like Godzilla takes the propeller off a helicopter and uses it like a ninja star, and you go, brilliant. You just go, great. That's what you want to see.
It's like it's Apocalypse Now meets King Kong, and it's just sort of like, it's not really tongue-in-cheek, but it's just like using all of this Vietnam iconography. And the poster was like a pastiche on Apocalypse Now, and it's just very... It's quite a nice. The soundtrack is incredible, and it's got like this really nice kind of look to it. And it's
full of really good moments, I think. Like and great
bit. And it's also like a cinematic language that it is bringing to another King Kong film. So if you look at the original King Kong and the 70s King Kong and the Peter Jackson King Kong, they're all trying to do the same thing. And the 70s King Kong is an update, but it's still trying to recreate the awe of the 30s Kong. Peter Jackson's King Kong is just a love letter to the 30s King Kong. So it's trying to sort of like replicate that 1930s feel with early 2000s CGI. And so this is sort of like... the first Western King Kong film where they've gone, we're going to throw that out and we're not going to be reverential to the original. We are literally just going to put a giant monkey in a movie. And it's incredible. It's not incredible, but
no,
it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
Exactly. It's 3.5 stars. It was great.
I saw a movie. So when I was young, I don't know. You didn't watch this, did you?
I don't know what you're about to talk about.
Well, so when I was young, I think it must have been on Channel 4, and my dad watched it, and I think my mum watched it. And I remember that there was another kid that lived over the fence from my house, and that kid had a dad. And my dad was either leaning on the garden fence or were in one of their gardens. And talking to the other dad, and he was telling the other guy about this movie called La Grande Bouffe.
I've not seen it.
And hang on, I've got a copy of it on DVD so that I can tell you all about it. What? Here you go. So my dad was telling this other dad this film, La Grande Bouffe. He said, oh, you've got to see it. And my dad was like crying with laughter, telling him about it. And so it's always been on my list. La Grande Bouffe, a film by Marco Ferreri. It simply means The Big Feast. And it's got this cast who I am reliably informed were international superstars. We've got Marcello Mastroianni. Mm-hmm. Who was he in 8.5? And
Dolce Vita.
Dolce Vita. You got Philippe Noiret.
So I know the name.
Le Cage Faux?
Maybe.
Faux too, which is what The Birdcage was based on. Ugo Tognazzi. I mean, I don't know these names. Mm-hmm. And Michel Piccoli. And one of those went on to be an Il Postino. But basically, you've got these, they're like Italian and French actors. You've got these four guys. And it's basically like the 1973 equivalent of an international Ocean's 11 movie. They're like it's like the Expendables. It's like the cream of the crop. It's like these guys are all fucking huge. And we're going to put them in a movie. Together, and it's this film where there are these four guys who I guess hate themselves, and they meet up around one of them is a chef, and they meet around one of their houses, and they just proceed to eat for the entire weekend until they die.
So they're trying to overeat themselves to death, like.
It's sort of like a suicide pact, but this is sort of like a twist. So, but I went into it knowing it, right?
Right.
Because this is how my dad described it. So my whole life, I knew it. But I watched it with my girlfriend, and she didn't know. Well, no, she did, because that's how I described it. But I watched it and I recommend it to you. I don't think it really hurts knowing what it's about going in, but I wonder what it's like not knowing what it's like going in. It's almost impossible to talk about it without like discussing it. So I guess you just have to say it. And if it doesn't sound like it's your sort of thing, it's not your sort of thing. It's one of the most disgusting films I've ever seen. but also I thought it was incredible. And it was one of those nights where you're like flicking through Netflix and then you go to Amazon Prime and there's nothing on telly. And then you're kind of like, oh God, what? And then it's like, and it was late. So I wasn't really in the mood for subtitles. You know, I get to about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and I'm like, no, I'm not doing subtitles at this point. I'm going to fall asleep. But we did it. And I said, La Grande Bouffe. And she said, yes. So we watched it. And it's incredible. So I was sort of like, we've got 5 minutes, so I'll do this quite quick. We've got some time now as well. So what I would say is, the human experience when it comes to films is like an elastic band, you know, and you see an Adam Sandler film and the limits of your mind is stretched to a two, right? And then every experience you have within that, you might get a one, you might get a two, when you're like, yeah, I've seen that. And then you see a Fast and the Furious film, and then your life is stretched to about a four, and you go, great. And then every Fast and the Furious film or Dwayne Johnson movie is about a four. It stretches your life up to about four, and it could be a two, it could be a one, could be within that bracket, but four is sort of like the limit of your experience by that point. And it's been, do you understand what I mean? So like, maybe you see Terminator 2 and you realise that that is actually one of the greatest films, action movies ever made. And then you go, oh, that, now it's a nine.
You've got limitations of what can happen in a film, you mean?
What you can do with a film. And then when you're like at a nine and every film has to live up to your experience of watching Terminator 2, it's kind of like you watch Fast and the Furious again and it's a three and you go, yeah. And I'm not like saying it's a 3 out of 5 or it's, I'm not rating it. I'm just like saying in terms of your experience watching a film. So all of the Fast and the Furious films, they might do different variations on a car chase, but they're all within a bracket.
Gotcha. So it's like what we were talking about before. It's almost like how star ratings don't really mean anything because you're constantly seeing more and then almost things get devalued by seeing them again and again. So you need to see something new.
Yeah, you need to see something new. Or it's like going to the gym, you know, or traveling. That's the furthest I've travelled, and now every journey I have is going to be shorter than that journey. And in being at your peak at the gym and then going to the gym again and then going, I didn't do quite as well as I did last time at the gym. You've got a new standard in your head. Mm-hmm. And I felt like Le Grand Bouffe was the first film that I'd seen in maybe 15, 20 years where I was like, well, maybe not that long, but it was the first film I'd seen in a very long, something like Audition, where you go, I didn't think that was possible to do that in a film. Mm-hmm. But this isn't a horror film. It's this comedy. And I laughed so hard at some of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. And I found it moving in places. The performances are great. And it was just this film where I came out of it and it's like, you're chasing a high now. You're like, oh, yeah, I want to watch another film, but what's the point if it's not going to be? It felt like a real treat because I felt like I was being offended, not in kind of like a modern way. I felt like I was being offended by this thing where I was just like going, I can't believe that they've done that in a film. I can't believe they put that on film. You know, I'm not outraged. I'm enjoying. It's like I'm being teased by the film. I'm enjoying the experience of being pushed to my limits on what I will sit down and watch. And I loved it. And it makes me sad to think that I'm going to have to sift through so much shit to find that.
To find
another thing that can beat the experience of watching that. So as a film experience, Nathaniel, I recommend it to you. Like a million, I think that you'd either love it or you'll hate it. I don't think you'll hate it. I thought I was losing my mind watching it, just thinking, this is absolutely incredible. I loved it. So there you go. I can't recommend it enough, but it's the most disgusting film I've ever seen, and it's fucking not for everyone. It's not for everyone, but my dad fucking loved it, which means that I have to have a rather serious chat with my dad, really, because it's just like, you're a fucking pervert, man. Don't bring mum into this. Fuck me, it's absolutely fucking disgusting. Should I just do a fan mail real quick?
Should we do one and see how we get on, or two, or hang on?
No, well, we've
yes,
got
please,
got
yes, here. Please.
Yes, please do two. Okay, right, we've got two pieces of fan mail. Brilliant, we've had 2 weeks off, that's one a week, Nathaniel. It was worth taking that break. here he is, the first fan mail of season 3. Hi, Nick and Nathaniel and Natalie. Belated congrats on making 100 episodes. I'm sure we've done more broadcasts. I'm on 108, so I've definitely heard at least 100 podcasts of fan club that you've made together. Taking the Tommy with.
Taking the Tommy Wiseau one and the one where Nick overslept and was late into account.
There's been fantastic guests and great scores on Better or Worse. Series 2 is brilliant. I've just discovered that instead of listening to the podcast on iTunes, I can listen to the broadcast straight from the Foobar app, so I get the songs as well. The cinemas have reopened. So do you recommend diving straight into serious stuff like Oscar winning Nomadland or Judas and the Black Messiah? Or gently easing myself back into reducing any social pandemic anxiety of sitting in a large room of strangers coughing everywhere or something light like Cruella? Those are lovely. Cruella's 2.25 hours long. I don't know how they've managed that.
Do you know what? I would say something like that human voice that I saw is a great one because it's very short. And it's quite nice to see something and not be in there for a long time. But I don't think you need to be especially worried. I think you should feel whatever you're comfortable with. And I guess it's whatever you want to watch. By all means, go and see Nomadland or Judas and the Black Messiah. But it should just be whatever makes you go, oh, I fancy seeing that.
Yeah, I saw Nomadland on Disney Plus, and I don't feel like my experience was lessened by watching it on TV. And what I will also say is I went to see Tenet and Bill and Ted at the cinema last year when we were able to. I felt perfectly safe because no one wants to go to the cinema, so it's completely empty. So it's kind of like you're better off in the cinema than you are in Sainsbury's.
I think especially you go during the day, and I think they've all set up things that you're not going to be sat next to anyone for the foreseeable anyway. You're going to be have seats around or blocked out and things, I think it seems. I know, for example, that last year when the cinemas were open in this country, there wasn't any outbreaks at all linked to any cinema in the whole country.
I mean, I missed it. It just depends on what, if you want to go and see it, I think. If you really want to go and see it at the cinema, I'll go and see it at the cinema. I thought Nomadland was absolutely fine to watch it on TV, and I enjoyed it.
I'd say if you're a bit worried, go during the day, and I think most cinemas now, you can kind of see where you're going to see it, and if you look at that screen when you're picking your seat, and it looks like loads of seats have been taken and you feel a bit uncomfortable, go another day. Pick it, just pick a time when it seems quiet, and then you'll kind of have most of the screen to yourself.
There you go.
Which is the best way anyway. Best way anyway.
Wise words from the expert there.
Good afternoon! Cinemas are open, hurrah! However, there isn't a lot to say about the Oscar winners. Do you have a favourite music festival and what was the best year and why? I'm hoping to go to a couple of local ones this summer. Sadly, they don't really have Comedy Sense. Dom Jolly doing a talk on Being Dom Jolly Love podcast. And hope you have Matthew Heighton okay sometime. On sometime. We've had Matthew Heighton.
If he's been on.
He came along. Okay. He's been on. So I don't know. If you want him back, then listen to that show again, because we did that one in the studio, and the mess he left in that studio. We're not allowed to book him back. So there you go. Festival? Have you ever been to a music festival, Nathaniel?
Do you know what? I've only ever been to perform at one. I've never been out of fun.
What were you doing? Your Bob Dylan covers, were you?
Yeah, doing Bob Dylan covers mainly. Yeah, yeah. Did a bit of tap dancing, modern tap. I've often gone to great lengths not to stay over at music festivals, and once went to one on the Isle of Wight, which was where I travelled all day to get there, was on stage for 15 minutes, left and came back home again because I didn't fancy staying overnight.
Is that the Isle of Wight Festival?
It was Best of All, doing comedy at Best of All.
Sure. I feel like I've done music festivals. Oh, cool. Our guest is in the waiting room. I feel like I've had my time I love festivals. I love festivals. I love music festivals. I'm looking forward to getting back out there and doing some music festivals. I don't know what I meant to say. let's play a song. Best year for music festivals, obviously, 1998. So let's play a song and get our guest in. Amazing guest today. 2020, 2024.
4 hours from now, I'm getting vaccinated. Waited so long that I wrote down this song about getting vaccinated. I tried to call the doctor, but I lost my phone. Hurry, 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 I feel so all alone. But shit, I live in Cali, I guess I'll just get down. Oh, 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 oh. Bam, 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 bam. I'm getting vaccinated. 20, 20, 24 seconds from now, I'm getting vaccinated. Took me so long even finish this song.
And Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We're back live. We're not live from pre-recorded on a Wednesday and it's out on a Friday. We're back in our studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my spare room and Nathaniel's in his washroom. And we're joined now by international superstar, founder of the bands Trainwreck and the Carl Gas Band. And, of course, a little band called Tenacious D. Put your hands together for that compo and we're not live. We're joined now by Carl Gass. Hello, Carl Gass. How are you?
Did you major in flattery? That's all I want to know.
I mean, I barely said anything complimentary, but I am very
because I am so stoked. I'm so pumped up now. I'm the starter of the D. I created him. I'm an international rock superstar. Oh, my God. Come on live.
I'm sorry.
I'm on live in London.
The great thing is we can't see a dog, so it looks like you've got a sound effects track.
It is. I have Foley, as we say.
As we
that
say
sounds like a real dog, doesn't it? Huh? All right, stop it, Dave.
You are actually, are you living on a farm as we speak?
It was a farm, I think, 100 years ago, but now it's, we're smack dab in North Hollywood in the big L.A. city, but... Yeah, 100 years ago, I think it was a farm. But I think even then it was kind of a pretend Hollywood farm. Like we'd sort of build it like a farm. And then, but it's a charmer. It's a charmer.
So you don't have animals, aside from that dog and the cat?
We just have, no, there's no goats or pigs or all the animals necessary for a farm. But I did write a song called Farmhouse Jubilee, which you just reminded me of. Come along with me to a place I know. I don't remember. I'm sorry. Okay. It's okay. A good one. Farmhouse Jubilee.
Did you write that in lockdown?
Yeah, there needs to be an excuse, I know. But unfortunately, it hasn't seen the light of day. But never say never. Nick.
Well, I'm disappointed about the farm. This is largely a farm-based podcast. So... Podcast radio show.
We're fake. We're a faux farm. It's Hollywood. Everything's fake.
Sure. Okay. Fake. Sure. You've got a new single coming out called "Vaccinated." That's coming out. Have you been vaccinated yet?
Well, it'd be pretty hypocritical of me to write a song vaccinated. Yes, I have.
Well, I'm half vaccinated, and I'm waiting. I've got to wait another 7 weeks for the other.
Did you get the one with the tracking device? Where they can find out where you are.
Yeah, it was really big. It was like an old TV monitor, and they just inserted it into the skin, and it took ages. So they were shoving it.
So inconvenient.
I've had two injections. That means I've got a tracking device in both of my arms. Now they know where both of them are.
You did it in the separate arms. That's what I wanted to do too.
I'm one each. That's got to be the even spread.
Yes, exactly.
But you don't get a choice. You don't get a, do you? Because people kept saying
I did. I got two Modernas. I was on it. Tim, you know, Bannon. I'm old too. We prioritized old people over here because I'm more likely to die than you, a young man as yourself.
Well, I don't feel. I feel like sure. Okay,
this is. Well, you're old, but I think you're very young.
Well, that's very kind of you. We're all full of compliments today.
You're the king of flattery. Yeah, I was just taking my cue from you, sir.
I know, it's lovely. It's really nice. Tell us about your single that you've got coming out. It's coming out on Friday the 4th of June.
I thought I was really being original. I was driving along and the Ramones song came on and it seemed to just go so well with the vaccinated, you know, the syllables and everything. And I just sort of, as we all do, you sort of do an instant parody. And I thought, wait a minute. Maybe I should spend 5 to 7 minutes maybe doing some... Maybe 8 minutes. I don't know. You know, I mean, I was ambitious that day. And so I did it, I thought. And then I did, I sort of had a trial on my Instagram. I just played it acoustic and just a little bit. And that went over pretty well. And I thought, well, maybe I should spend another 7 minutes and go lay it down in the studio. And then a little while later, I thought, you know, I was patting myself on the back of how, and then I just typed in vaccinated Ramones, and then people had made like 4 or 5 videos parodying. And honestly, I didn't know. I live in a bubble, a Hollywood bubble here. And it was really the most unoriginal idea that one could come up with.
We disappointed.
I did think that, I do think mine is far and away the best one. Yeah. And they don't have celebrities in their video, which is coming out Friday. Don't miss it. DIY celebrities everywhere.
Well, it's coming. I looked it up earlier.
Video for Vaccinated Friday. That's right. You got the scoop.
It's in like 30.
What's the radio station? KAGE?
FUBAR. Because we are effed up beyond all recognition. your video goes live in about 38 hours because I remember looking it up about 3 hours ago and it wasn't live for 41 hours. So I think about 38 hours now. Very exciting. That's actually me and Nathaniel are both British stand-up comedians, and I.
And radio was kind of the plan B. It was like, if things don't work out, maybe the radio, maybe a podcast. I don't know. What can we do? What can we do?
When you say you're going to put aside 5 to 7 minutes to write a song, it really does bring into context, into sharp focus, how much of the last year and a half I've wasted. I could have... If you like, I write songs. But when you actually just say 5 to 7, I'm going to put aside 5 to 7 minutes to do it. I always think of it as like this unclimbable mountain.
You know, it's little bite-sized nuggets. That's what you do. Don't think about eating the whole elephant. You just eat a part of them.
Yeah, and then you're right. There.
You could have a hit album in 37 minutes, well spaced.
If we get nothing else out of this interview, you've blown my mind.
I'm pretty sure at this point.
I think the 5 to 7 minutes is.
Call Tony Robbins. We've got a self-help scoop.
So what's it like being in Tenacious D?
Well, there's a lot of waiting. You know, the older we get, the longer our careers go, it takes a long time to get something going. But it's great, really. You know, you get to be in Tenacious D. There's only two of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's pretty fun. It's a small club.
I read that you two kind of became friends when you were both performing in a play at the Edinburgh Festival. Is that right?
Yeah, that is true. Well, we were just a bit before that, but that was we actually weren't. Even really friends yet. He just subbed in, understudied, and we were going on this big, long adventure to Edinburgh and then to New York. Joe Papp's festival or a public theater there, and it was quite a thing. And he was a talented young man, and yeah, he got on there, and then we became somewhat close. But then afterwards, we were kind of in the same world. But you know, he's 9-10 years younger than me, so he's kind of like, "Who is this punk?" At my heels, get him off me. No.
What was the play that you did in Edinburgh? Do you remember much about any of the festival?
Original called Carnage, and it was about TV evangelists and religion and frauds and grifters, and it was pretty good. It kind of made a lot of noise here, and it was around the time all the there was a lot of scandals going on in the, like, those TV ministries, and they
sure
they take your money and all that stuff, and they were so yeah. Carnage, a comedy, I believe it was called. That was in the late 80s. Can you believe that? 89.
I can believe it. I mean, I did my first Edinburgh Festival in 1997.
There you go. Even you're going way back 10 years later than my way back.
Do you remember which venue you were in?
It was a church, and I don't remember the name of it, but it was, it was a church. You know, of course, the venues are everywhere. Oh, wait, was that what a church? We were a main selection. No, actually, or we did a couple performances in a church, and some in this large theater with a quite a raked audience, I remember. It was quite large. I don't know if anyone knew what the hell we were doing.
Because you were both part of... The Actors.
Yeah, there was a theater group that originated out of UCLA. After college, you major in theater, and then like, there's not really a solid career path for you. So you would do a lot. A common thing was to do a lot of, they call it equity waiver theater, which was small 99-cent theater, 99-seat theater rather.
But I think of that thing now because I remember like hearing about that years ago because it was Tim Robbins was kind of the guy who seemed to be the kind of main guy behind it. And I think here when you'd hear about it and all the kind of actors that were involved in it, it felt a bit like a kind of, what was it, Orson Welles' Mercury Theatre, I guess. That it sort of has that sort of feeling.
Actually,
about it.
I think in our dreams, that was that was what we were. Yeah, we were pretty, it's still going on, actually. Tim is still carrying on.
Oh, so he's still behind it now, and it's still... But there's, tons of actors, right, that have come from
When you say tons of actors, I don't remember, really, making it out. I mean, Jack obviously got pretty huge, and Tim's very large, but I'm still a minor character. Who else we got out of there? Who are you thinking?
I was thinking... Wasn't John Cusack? Was he involved?
John Cusack, somewhat... In sort of a Chicago edition of the Actors.
Okay, so you got your main guys, and then you've got sort of a splinter satellite people, have you?
In Chicago, called the New Crime.
Okay. It all seemed very exciting. Like, I remember, like, reading about it, and it sounds like, all right, this sounds like a proper, it's like a new type of... But what was it? What kind of plays would you put on? Was it kind of experimental, or was it?
They were like politically charged. They were definitely on the political theater bent. And then we also adopted this in 1984. Georges Bugeaud from a theater in France came over and did this seminar or something at the Olympic Arts Festival. And Tim and some people picked up on this. The style, we called it, and it was based on old Italian, the Commedia dell'arte, and all that.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
So did all that, and just got heavily into that for a long time, and that was kind of the main thing. So it was definitely not more presentational than realistic, as we'd say, and it was somewhat experimental, I would say, but it was pretty exciting. We tried to do it. We try to get attention and make it kind of dangerous and as much as you could in the theater. And we made some noise. There was lots of music in it, which I got to participate in and create a lot of it. So it was a great, kind of training ground. Also a way to kind of work on, just work on your craft and hopefully get noticed and get some actual work in TV and movies too. That was, it was kind of hopefully helping out in that regard. But it was a, we were, you know, we consider ourselves theater artists and trying to do good stuff.
I watched recently.
You watched Frasier? What were you going to say?
I watched Frasier recently. What were you going to say, Nathaniel?
Oh, no, I was going to say, I saw as well that I watched it recently, the film Braindead, which has a lot of people
that's
from
my
that.
First movie.
Yeah, I'd never seen it before.
And it was, you know, it was Roger Corman, the famous Roger Corman. Are you an aficionado of the cinema?
Of Roger Corman?
Of the cinema in general.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you must be.
You're going deep into that. That was a great way to start in the movie business, was doing a Roger. I remember you moved so fast from scene to scene. I mean, it was, you know, they're legendarily low budget, and it was pretty, yeah, it was pretty fun.
If that's your first film, though, are you like, does that just seem normal, working at that speed?
What's that?
If that's your first movie and you're saying, oh, it kind of moves so fast.
Even my first one, even I was, yeah, having never worked in one, I knew like, whoa, we are moving along. And it didn't seem like anything had to really be absolutely correct. And yeah, so no experience. I still knew. It was a low budget. Instinct told me.
And is it fun working on a movie like that?
You know, working is pretty fun. It's definitely for actors. There's definitely the hurry up and wait. There's a lot of, but then you know you're actors, so you're just jawing and talking and hanging out and drinking coffee and going to the craft service table and hanging out in your trailer and flirting with other cast members and you know doing the wrong things. but it is that job 99% boredom and 1% terror when you have to deliver. It's like, but that's kind of what you're getting paid for, is to deliver. But a very small part in that one, as is most of my film career, is a lot of small parts.
But because you're in the Cable Guy as well, right? At the end, when he breaks the satellite dish, you're the guy that picks up the book and starts reading, right?
Yes, and I represent the transition where we get away from technology and back to the simpler things, but, like reading a book.
But the way that you read the book is you put your whole hand on the page and you kind of like...
The way I read the book was bad acting. Okay, is that what your point is, Nick?
No.
Tough day on the set, all right? I didn't really nail it.
No, I think it's one of the most... I think it's one of the standout moments of the film. And it changed the way I read books.
Look at that guy, Nick. That's how he got his major in flattery. He draws you in with compliments, and then boom. Now, you're really used to it, Nathaniel, I can tell. It's like, I've seen it before. He's setting him up. Boom. I actually did a whole bit on that moment in my on my podcast. Mm. Did We Do It? I'm plugging my other podcast. But, that was a tough day on the set. I couldn't get it. Ben Stiller was the director. He had to shut down the set because he obviously had an actor that was in over his head. And it was one of the hardest days I've ever had. It was hard.
Are you joking?
No, it was a simple moment, but it was a really big movie. And there was about, as opposed to Braindead, which was a low budget. This was a large budget. They had plenty of people. They had 100 people out there doing something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just had to sort of walk into the set and do my bit. And I got a little, I have to say it, I kind of froze a little bit. It was tough and I couldn't. So what you saw was the end of like Ben talking me off the ledge and getting me to do it the way it was. But I know it's,
I don't know.
At this moment, what can I say?
I don't know if you need to hear this or if you want to hear this, but I think that is one of the most perfect moments in the film. I think it's great. It's really stuck with me. Yeah, it's crazy to think that
was
difficult.
Well, thank you. That's nice.
I, I love that bit because the film is so stressful up until that. And then when you have that moment, I think everyone in the audience breathes a sigh of relief. And yeah, it's great. It's fascinating. Sometimes
maybe that is my mission, is to bring a sense of calm, really.
What is your favorite film?
My favorite film?
Yeah.
I really like Rosemary's Baby. One of my favorite all-time films.
Terrific film.
Why do you like Rosemary's Baby?
Well, I had a strange... it was in my parents' library, Ira Levin classic, and it's very accessible. It's kind of a short novel with big print, so I was very young at the time. And I read it, and I really enjoyed it. And then they made a film out of it, and it was very faithful to the book. And I just love everything about it. I just love the story. I love the direction. I love Cassavetes and Mia Farrow. And it was just the craziest story. And to take something that sort of outlandish, you know, she has sex with the devil. To make that suspension of disbelief, to make it seem like this is really happening, is such a directorial thing. And just the style of it, the New York City and the Bramford building, which was, of course, the famous apartment building that John Lennon lived in. I forget the name of it.
Yeah.
My favorites. Another one is actually a Polanski film, too, is Chinatown. I'm a big Polanski. Sure. Not a fan of his personals. It's probably wrong to be celebrating him, but I think you can talk
about the films as a film. Like, one of my favorite films is Fearless Vampire Killers, which was Polanski.
Did he direct it?
Yeah, he directed it. Yeah. And
with Sharon Tate.
Was that Tarantino co-wrote it with somebody?
Oh, no. What's that?
I'm sorry, that's the one.
That's anyway. Later on.
Yes.
So Rosemary's Baby was originally, that was a William Castle production.
Mm.
And he wanted to direct that, and then Roman Polanski kind of did it. And so William Castle ended up having like a cameo.
When you watch it now, it feels like the origin of all those sort of 70s conspiracy thrillers like 3 Days of the Condor or Paranoid View. Yeah. It has that, but it's not political. It's literally like a diabolic cult.
It's a personal conspiracy. Yeah.
That's but really it has true. That exactly the same feel. It's like when you watch that, I felt like that's almost like the origin of those films, or that's how they've made those films, almost based on her experience of just not knowing.
It could have been, part of the times, though, that the outside forces were, you know, controlling things, and you didn't have.
And it is great. I love all that. It's that thing where it is almost that thing now. We talk about gaslighting. That's the way it's sort of perceived, except she's right.
Right.
I
know. That's the thing. Yeah, you can't believe. Of course, that couldn't possibly be happening.
It's a great movie.
It's just spot on. It's just the. I just love how the actor is just portrayed as the self-absorbed villain, where only thing that matters is his career advancement. But the reality that they paint is that he's just has very little talent. And the guy that went blind is actually Donald Baumgart, I remember his name, was actually the guy with talent. And no matter, they made him blind and he still succeeded. It was a nice little twist while he was doing Yamaha commercials.
But it's sort of like making a pact with The Godfather and getting a career as an actor, isn't it?
Yeah, Johnny Fontaine, as we remember.
And then you also have like the two neighbors, and they're sort of a bit like the two women in Don't Look Now. And
yes.
you have all of these films that seem to be kind of like, and The Exorcist as well, but you have all of these films that sort of like spiral out of Rosemary's Baby.
That is really true. I hadn't really made that, but I hadn't thought of it that way.
It's another
have
one.
Have you ever seen, oh, go on.
I was just going to say, it's another one where the sort of diabolism kind of, it's quite comforting. It's quite a nice, it's not, by the end of it, it's sort of quite pleasant. It's not, you know, it doesn't feel like anything terrible is happening. It's just this sort of quite, and I guess at the time it was written, it was probably all that kind of Church of Satan idea, wasn't it? Where it was all that kind of, everything was more secular. It wasn't
It literally was, they took the real Time magazine cover. God is dead. Scott, and it was, that was sort of a real sort of issue at the time. How could things be? So
isn't that in the waiting room as well? When she's, I think that might be in one of the scenes, in one of the doctor's waiting room or something. I think she might have a copy of that Time magazine. But yeah, such a great kind of movie, like real about the time. Really feels like a kind of, what's the word? Like a time stamp of that era.
A
time capsule. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It just grabs that opening song about la 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 dee doo dee. It's just brilliant. It's like, what the? All of a sudden, I'm drawn in with this lullaby. It's the creepiest thing, and it's just Central Park going by, and New York is just beautiful.
I can't remember the music. But have you seen Suspiria? And are you aware of the band Goblin?
Yeah, but have you seen Another Round?
No.
What's Another Round?
With Mads. That actor Mads something or other.
It hasn't arrived here yet. Yeah, it's coming out in next month, I think.
What? Where are you? Where are you guys?
We're in the UK.
We're in London.
What? And you haven't got it? It's on, like, streaming services, for God's sake.
Oh, no, it's because the cinemas are reopening, so there's lots of things coming back.
Oh, and they're holding them back. Well, let me tell you something. This one won best international film over here in the Oscars. Someone told me about it, and then right after, I thought this actor is like the best actor in the world. I don't know this guy. I don't know
Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah, Mads Mikkelsen. I've seen him before, and he's just obviously. And then someone recommends Riders of Justice. Have you heard of that one?
That's him too, right?
That's him too. Of course, a totally different role, really shown his range, and it crushes too. It's just, it's amazing.
Have you seen the film The Hunt, starring Mads Mikkelsen?
That'll be the next one. Is that
right? Write that down. There's a new film called The Hunt.
I'm in.
The Hunt. There's a new film called There's a new film called The Hunt, which is all about politics, and it's like battle royale. But it's not that. It's an old film called The Hunt, and I remember it came out at the same time as Jack Reacher. And in Jack Reacher, you've got Tom Cruise playing a 7-foot-tall blonde guy. And then in The Hunt, you've got
Scientologist, after all, and they have the power.
But at the very same time, you've got a guy that's like a similar age to Tom Cruise that's playing this very detailed kind of story about a teacher that gets wrongly accused of touching a kid. And it's like, this really sort of like intense, incredible film that was really well, you know, it's like Mads Mikkelsen's incredible in it. And then on the other side, you've got Tom Cruise is making Jet Reacher, and you're just kind of like, oh, grow up!
Was incredible. Did you see Doubt with Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman?
I didn't see Doubt.
It is very well done, but it's that sort of like, did he do it or didn't he do it? He's a priest. And of course he's accused of...
He's also the villain, isn't he, in the Bond film Casino Royale, where he's a poker player who cries blood every time he's got a bad hand or something, which strikes me as like a disadvantage. But he's like poker player in the world.
Yeah. I think
I don't think that would work, would it?
They ruin their case there. Philip Seymour Hoffman, though, is actually, I don't know, he might be my favorite all-time actor. Did you see Before the Devil Knows You're Dead?
Who's in that?
Philip Seymour Hoffman and the other guy. I forget his name. But it was also a famous director's last film. I can't think of his name either.
Okay, hang on.
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. It's just the most amazing.
Sidney Lumet?
Yeah.
Starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, Ethan Hawke. This is basically now going to deteriorate into us saying, have you seen, and then looking it up on our phones.
That's why we have these devices.
Exactly.
It's great.
Are we supposed to pretend we don't have all the information at our fingertips?
Sidney Lumet. I didn't see that. What was the film that was written by Paul Schrader that had Ethan Hawke in it as a priest?
Oh, it's First Reformed.
First Reformed. Did you see First Reformed?
Yeah, and I love Ethan Hawke.
Oh, yep. Man! It's so incredible. It's like this film where it's about a priest. I don't know if I really want to watch a film by Paul Schrader about Catholicism, and then I get
Taxi Driver. Don't forget.
Yes. Yes.
I've realised normally this show, Kyle, is this for the first hour. And the second hour, we get a guest on who grounds us more, and we stop talking about...
Oh, my God, I'm taking up... You're saying I can be regular on your show.
Can you come back every week?
Of course. Hardcore. You remember Hardcore, the Paul Schrader film?
I've never seen Hardcore.
Oh, you got to see Hardcore.
Is it good?
It's great. I look it up on the thing. You got your device.
Did you see... Calvary? Did you see the film Calvary with Brendan Gleeson as a priest?
No, we're gonna have a priest festival though, I think.
Sure, I watched it 2 weeks ago and it was excellent stuff. One of your favorite films,
by the way, aren't they just way afield? I mean, haven't they proven themselves to be a really rotten institution, the priesthood?
Oh, for sure.
Well, yeah, but then if we
They're
got rid of them, then...
If any other profession had that sort of track record...
Sure. But have you seen the Bing Crosby movie, Going My Way?
Well, of course. It's an American classic.
Well, that's... he seems like a nice priest.
Well, there you go. Well, all right. Then you're right, then. Yeah. That movie was made in 1934 about the priesthood definitely is an accurate representation.
I think that on the scales that tips it in the favor, right? You got all the bad things, but you got Going My Way. That's a nice jolly movie.
And then there's also the film We Are Now Angels, starring Robert De Niro and Sean Penn, and they're not priests, but they're pretending to be priests.
They were pretending to be priests, but I remember that has the funniest scene where Sean has to deliver a speech impromptu and as a priest, and he rises to the occasion and gives some wisdom from the other side that seemed almost priest-like. Sean is a tremendous actor, but what a tremendous actor! Actually, hung out with him after we did the after party. Believe it or not. Jack and I played, because Jack had a small role in Dead Man Walking.
Right.
And for some reason, somebody thought it was a good idea for us to play the after party, which is just like, that's what you want. That's what you want. You want some couple heavy set. And it was really, I don't know, I forget what year it was, but we were kind of sort of happening, but it was definitely no one wanted to stop the music. Stop the music! Two guys with the guitars have some funny songs to play.
Is that the wrap party for the film, or is that the premiere, or the screening?
That was the wrap party.
Right.
The wrap is the end. We wrapped.
Yeah.
Are you, is that what you're asking?
But it wasn't like at the screening, where you watched Dead Man Walking and then Tenacious D come out.
There was a bar.
Sure. It makes more sense that it's the wrap party.
Mm. I feel this happens a lot in the comedy world as well, where people run an event and think, we want some comedians on now. And you think, you absolutely don't. This is the worst possible. So no one here wants this. People are quite happy drinking and chatting.
I've been around these situations so long. I can just ask me. I'll tell you. No, they don't want that now. You're absolutely right. Comedians don't want to see a comic. That's the last thing comedians want.
But it's also like when people try and book you for a wedding and you say, you don't want this. You don't want this.
I have to say, I'm playing a wedding July 10th of a friend. And I try to play everyone. They're the greatest. They're the greatest gigs to play.
But weddings?
Oh yeah, no, they're well photographed. It's just everyone. It's just such an event you get to be a part of. I just enjoy it. I like the vibe. And the ironically, I don't even believe in weddings or marriage, but they're just a wonderful theatrical event.
What do you play when you play at a wedding?
Well, I was, this was a strange kind of a friend's niece, and they're in Chicago, and he was just asking on the outside, and he had a request. He heard me play Over the Rainbow was a special request. I do a nice little solo arrangement of that. But, you know, I'll be ready if someone yells out a tune. Play tribute. Okay, here we go. Do-do-do-do-do. But, you know. That's our job. We have to entertain. We'll just stand up there and entertain. It's like you're thrown into the pool. Start swimming.
Have you ever seen the Two Jakes?
Hmm. Two Jakes? Is that in your head?
Well, it's the sequel to Chinatown.
It's terrible. Absolutely terrible. Terrible movie. I think, didn't Jack Nicholson try to direct that, I think?
I think so.
Yeah, that was bad. Don't direct. He also directed Missouri Breaks, I think, didn't he?
I've not seen that.
That's a real misfire. It was Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson. And it was kind of like, they're in the same movie. It's got to be great. Everyone, this is, until people realized, oh, you got to have some kind of script. You can't just cast it.
Yeah.
I think that's a mistake so often made in Hollywood.
It's like, but that's
because casting is so important that if you get the right people, and it's really to make a good movie, as you guys know, the stars have to align. You have to get a bunch of things.
But Jack Nicholson was offered The Godfather, and he deliberately turned it down. One of the reasons he turned it down was because he didn't have enough screen time with Marlon Brando, and he was just like, I'm going to do a film with Marlon Brando, and I might only make one film with Marlon Brando, and so I'm going to turn down The Godfather. And then he did Missouri Breaks, which is a pile of shit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you don't know. Everyone starts off trying to make the great movie. You don't know. It's a bit. Hindsight's 20/20.
Sure. No, you're absolutely right.
You're so hard on these people.
I'm sorry. It's just that
your creativity is a very, you know.
No, you're right. And I think he would have been wrong for Godfather as well. So he made the right choice.
Godfather is kind of considered our Citizen Kane now, really. It's kind of risen to like, oh, we can all agree that the Godfather's that's our best American film, isn't it? And I think they might be right.
Else would it be?
What else would the best?
Because officially the number one film is Vertigo, isn't it?
No.
Officially.
Mm-hmm.
Officially.
It was Citizen Kane for a very long time, and then Vertigo came in and pipped it.
And then Vertigo, huh? Well, I would disagree with that. And now I think we have to cancel Alfred, too. Unfortunately, he was not nice. He was mean to his leading ladies. It was always such a charming affectation that he always cast the icy blondes. Little did we know that he was just kind of stalking and obsessed with them, being a weirdo. God love him.
But I guess technically he's one of ours.
Is he?
Yeah, English. Yeah, he's English.
He was English.
Yeah, of course, that accent. Well, all you guys have the fake accent, so I mean,
yeah.
It's always hard to say.
Yeah.
Where is he from?
He's from, I believe, Leytonstone in London. He's from East London.
Yeah, there you go.
That's
where the problem is.
You've heard about Leytonstone, right?
Who hasn't?
What about music? What do you listen to? What's the music?
Do I have to review that?
Yeah, I'm afraid you do. It's part of it.
It's like a deposition. This thing. Mm-hmm. Music, I've always been... first off, I'm not like a big fan. I mean, more than others. I don't like collect it, and it's a very random experience. And since I was a wee lad, I've always listened to the radio. I've kind of been a radio head, like the band. But just sort of what pops into my transom. And then if I like an artist, I'll sort of go in a little deeper. But not, yeah, it's just it's a random universe with music.
You're not someone who's specifically into like rock music or specifically into anything you like.
Well, I will say rock. You know, rock was king growing up. Rock and pop, I think I have a real, I have a really soft side on the music. I like 70s pop and, but you know, when you break it down, it's always been about songs. I think songs are just a case by case. I think there's good songs and there's mediocre songs and there's bad songs and songs are songs. And that's kind of my job too. So I'm always listening and trying to steal or, you know, get inspired or something. I think when it's kind of your job, it's different. I mean, I love music, but I love like a 3-minute perfect kind of pop hit. You know, I think that's always been kind of a brilliant.
I guess that era though, that kind of 70s radio era is what you kind of think of, don't you, as those kind of perfect pop songs.
Yeah, just when rock was top of the charts. It seems so strange now.
But, do you have favorites from those, or do you have anything that you could kind of narrow down?
To the thing, when I woke up this morning, you were on my mind. You were on my. Was that the Seekers? No, although I was listening to the Seekers yesterday. Are they from over there?
Are they from over there?
So the new Seekers as well.
Yeah, there's a Seekers and a new Seekers, isn't there?
Mm. I like a lot of that sort of early folk stuff, too. I like kind of like Greenwich Village. I like the Dylan. I've always had a Neil Young thing. I like kind of that L.A. Folk rock sort of thing. I like that whole movement.
Have you seen that documentary series? The Seekers are from Melbourne. Did you see the documentary series Laurel Canyon? The Laurel Canyon documentary series?
You know, I think I have it, and I think it's permanently paused right now. It's one of those eras and things, especially, you know, I live like five minutes away. It's almost been over-documented now, where I've seen a lot of it, and I'm a sucker for any kind of rock doc or anything like that, so I'll just get sucked in. But that whole era and stuff, I'm pretty familiar with. I don't have to revisit it too much. I love the Buffalo Springfield. Oh, they were good, speaking of that back in the day.
Have you ever heard of a musician called Steve Forbert?
Yes, he had that hit. What was that one? Romeo's tune. He had that big hit, and it seemed like, and he was on the cover of the Rolling Stone, and he was the new Dylan. Is that you? Are you really Steve Forbert?
No, I'm not really Steve Forbert, but I'm a big Steve Forbert.
Why did you bring him up? Is he good?
Or
what's his best album?
Because his best album is Jackrabbit Slim, and he wrote a song called Laurel Canyon. Yeah, he said rabbit, actually. Yes, he did. And so the album was Jackrabbit Slim, and he had a song on Alive on Arrival called Laurel Canyon, to Laurel, and it made me think of it. And then I thought, I've never met anyone that's ever heard of him, and I thought maybe you had.
And I have.
And you have.
Steve Forbert.
So thanks for coming on.
The new Seekers are from London. So the Seekers are from Melbourne, and the new Seekers are from London.
You know what, right? In my mind, I thought the Seekers were from Australia, and I wish I'd said it now, because it may would have made me look clever.
Yeah, that song.
I gotta be on your show, guys. Right? I'm in a movie aficionado. Here I come. Oh, that's right. I remember. He has a weak voice. And that's why I didn't.
What did you say? What did you say about his voice?
He's a little bit weak vocally, I think.
I think he's got. I think he's got a lovely voice.
Of course, he has a wonderful emotive voice. I was just for success terms, I think, just for our talent at the time.
Sure, I understand. But I tell you what, because everybody automatically assumes that I am just into heavy metal music. And then say, no, I like lots of people. I like Steve Forbert. And then people say, who's Steve Forbert? And you go, well, he's this guy. He's sort of pop folk.
Yeah. What's his second best song? What's his second best song?
That whole album is great.
Yeah.
I think it's a perfect album.
Wow. You're saying it's like Appetite for Destruction, just a perfect album.
Yeah, I would say it was like Appetite for Destruction. I would say that you could put Jet Rabbit Slim on and listen to it from beginning to end, and it's an easy listen.
Is this the one?
It's all good.
What song is it, though?
I don't know. This is going down to Laurel.
Oh, I already like it. This one can play us out, guys. Hey, this has been a great time. What's the name of your show? I forget.
Fan Club.
With Nick and Nate. I'm going to change your name to Nate.
Nathaniel. That's right.
Oh, it's kind of pretentious. Oh, well. We're Fan Club. Today has been Kyle Gass. What a great show. He's probably been the best guest we've ever had. He would just shut up and give me the word edgewise. We talked about Steve Forbert. Good night, you guys.
The thing is, that is more professional than the show's ever been. That's more radio. That's how we're supposed to do it.
But you don't get to do that, Carl. You don't get to finish our show for us. We have to plough it into the side of the mountain ourselves.
I can't believe I'm the first guest that's wanted to stay. Isn't that true?
That's true.
You're in a small list of people, at least. We are wrapping it up now, though, right?
What are we doing? It's your show.
I put on
a cheaty hour. I told my manager 20 minutes maximum, and it's an hour. You squeeze me. You win.
It's an hour. We should probably tell you at the 56-minute mark, it is an hour.
I rounded up. What the hell?
I've got to hand you out. Your single, Vaccinated, comes out on the 4th of yes. June, which will be today.
It's out when now. It's out now. The video drops Friday the 4th. I don't know. When this airs, when next year?
On Friday the 4th.
Friday?
Mm-hmm. Go Friday right 4th. Now.
Get right Fine. Now.
Go on your Google. If you have a Google search bar, type in Vaccinated Kyle Gass. Excuse me. Now remember, this video was made with $0 budget. So don't be expecting some high flying special effects or anything.
It's not Avatar. That's what I've heard.
Wait, hold on now.
Oh,
where
sorry.
Do you come down on Avatar? Where do you
okay,
come down?
Nothing. I'm saying it's.
Where are you saying about Avatar?
All right, then, I'm saying it is like Avatar.
What do you think of the movie?
Do you know what? I never saw it. I never saw it.
You never seen Avatar?
No.
Why were you cartoons?
I didn't know it was like, I didn't realize it was that big a movie. I thought it was a movie I could skip. And then later on, I realized it was like the biggest film that had ever come out. So I went, I probably should have seen that.
What do you think was better? Is there that or Titanic? What do you think was the better movie?
Titanic's much better. But also, Avatar's a film that nobody mentioned after they saw it. It's like
that was why. I never heard anyone mention it.
It was the biggest film of all time, and then as soon as it came out, everyone watched it, and then nobody mentioned it ever again.
Isn't that interesting? There's something about being the biggest. It can't possibly be the best. The only thing that was ever the biggest and the best were the Beatles. I'm saying that's the only thing. But if you get too popular, that's just, it's almost like Einstein's, it has to slow down. You can't be that good.
Sure. Speaking of being the best, Nathaniel is now going to, for the first, oh, wow, for the first guest of the season, Carl Gass. You are now going to play, if you please, Better or Worse with Nathaniel Metcalf.
Okay, this game's called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based on my own opinions to score points. Okay, beginning with Mariah Carey. But is Cher better or worse than Mariah Carey, according to me?
According to you, I would say Mariah Carey is better than Cher.
Nah, Cher. Is Celine Dion better or worse than Cher?
Celine Dion is better than Cher.
Worse.
Okay.
Sammy Davis Jr., better or worse than Celine Dion?
I have to answer that?
That's what I think.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't know what the hell you think. I just met you.
That's
I'm just gonna
right.
tell you straight up, y'all. Sammy Davis is one of the greatest of all time.
He is. He's better. Fresh Elizabeth up. Taylor, better or worse than Sammy Davis Jr.?
Apples and oranges.
Sure. That's how it works.
Better
it can both be high cards, but someone has to be better, according to me.
Sophie's choice, eh? I got
right, so that's how it works.
All right. Well, who
tough questions.
Again?
Sammy Davis Jr., Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, Sammy Davis.
Sammy Davis Jr.
Peter Cushing, better or worse than Elizabeth Taylor?
I don't know.
You don't know who Peter Cushing is?
Peter Cushing, wait. That sounds familiar.
You bet.
Van Helsing in Christopher Lee Dracula films.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't know.
He's better.
He's better. Okay.
He's better. Christopher Lee, better or worse than Peter Cushing?
I'm going to go Christopher Lee, just because I don't know Peter Cushing.
Worse. Bruce
what?
Lee.
What?
Bruce hey. Lee, better or worse than Peter than Christopher Lee?
I'm going to go
worse.
I guess better. He's got to be better than me. He's got to be better. Bruce Willis, better or worse than Bruce Lee?
Worse.
Roy Scheider, better or worse than Bruce Willis?
Oh, God, way better.
Better.
Roy Orbison, better or worse than Roy Scheider?
Who?
Roy Orbison.
Better? He's definitely, he's a better Roy.
Better Roy. Correct.
That's all right.
What's this?
For a while.
So what's the score?
Six.
You scored six. You scored a six.
Yep.
Which, for the first guest of this season, a six is not bad, Kyle.
Wait, so I'm the you. First? I'm the first?
Of yeah. this series? Yeah, this is series.
Oh, that guy. Oh, I know. Yeah, everybody knows this guy.
Yeah, come on, yeah, guy. Of course. Cushing. Peter Cushing.
Okay. He's one of those guys, you know, I don't know his name.
He's in Star
oh, he's
Wars.
Great. He's great. He was in Star Wars? Yeah, I don't like Star Wars.
Okay.
Whoa. Well, that's fine. We're not big on it. We haven't got time for anything else. So goodbye, everybody. Hope you're all right. It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Nathaniel. It's goodbye from Carl Gass. Thank you very much. And look after each other. We're not out of the woods yet, but we almost are. See you, listen to you next week. Bye.
Way back in time, someone said try some. I tried some, now buy some. I bought some. Whoa, whoa, whoa. After a while, when I had tried.